A warm welcome to our Thursdays with David Foster Wallace series, where we every week read a section of the infamous Infinite Jest with the hope, of course, of finishing the book by the end of the month, you guys. Today's section is 883 to 916 in the 20th anniversary Back Bay Books edition of the text published by Little Brown and Company. I am so psyched to finish this book. I don't know if you can tell, probably. We are doing another double episode next week. We'll be finishing Infinite Jest by the end of the month. As I said, we're going to have a very special anniversary episode next week on Monday as well. So keep your eyes out for that. I'll be reviewing my first ever podcast and listening to it through. And I have already made that episode, and it's just a really fun exercise that I did. There's a couple things actually that I was really surprised about, for example, in my first episode. So if you're interested in Podcast Classic, if you're interested in the DHI anniversary of this, we're turning three, you guys. This is amazing. If you're interested in all of that, go on, wait until Monday. That will be uploaded promptly, probably on Sunday actually. And patrons, thank you for sponsoring this episode and indeed every episode of late. It's really, really important to us that we are advertising in a way that is genuine, in a way that is meaningful to people, and you guys, patrons, make it possible. You guys make it possible that we get to read Infinite Jest, that we get to do all these fun things, and that we get to plan for our future in the way that we have been. So thank you guys so much. If you're interested in becoming a patron, patreon.com/relevanceofliterature. Interestingly, for today, we start out on page 883 with a Fantod's quote. Quote, "None of this has sunk in enough to give him the howlers," which I think is sort of a similar kind of phrase to Fantod. So there's that for our future episode, of course. We start out pretty happily here, actually, in this section. A notebook and a pen are handed to Gately. Gately's in the hospital still. He's still in a lot of pain. His arm still looks like a second head because it's wrapped so thickly. Ferocious Francis also is there to visit him, so that's another plus for Gately. He's been anticipating Ferocious Francis for quite a while, especially since it seemed like Jim and Condenza, when he visited Gately as a wraith, he was predicting, okay, Ferocious Francis is, you know, getting his neat, he's shaving, is getting his neat shirt on right now, he's gonna come visit you. And throughout this section, and indeed throughout all of these Gately sections, we see that Gately is thinking of words, there's some strange behaviors coming from the other characters, which makes me think that a wraith, whether it's Jim and Condenza or some other force, is affecting these people's thoughts, maybe getting inside their minds in the way that a wraith, now that we know what wraiths do, in the way that a wraith does. On 884, I thought this was just a really cool, personal sort of thing that DFW was able to add into his printing, and Gately, when he is saying hello to Ferocious Francis, he writes yo in his notebook, and it's really garbled, and there's really nothing funnier than just looking at this garbled yo in the middle of this beautifully typewritten page of text. This also happens later when they're talking about Gately's intro into drugs, which we'll get into in a minute, and there's this logo that he is also thinking about, that's also written into the pages in a sort of handwriting, which is really amazing. Somehow Francis has gotten the truth about this pet situation. I'm not sure where he heard it. It seems like he's sort of a conspirator in many ways. So it seems like the news about Lens essentially killing pets has been going around. Francis doesn't know that it's Lens initially. Gately is telling him it was Lens, you know. And there's a lot in this Lens narrative that still needs to be answered. And I'm not sure that we will get answers in terms of, for example, where is the gun? Did Lens take the gun? And we'll get into more of those questions in a minute. The MD, there's a specific MD that Gately hates, and he interrupts their conversation. He effectively ends the meeting between Gately and Ferocious Francis, and he's trying to get Gately on narcotics, like any sort of narcotic. He's like, oh yeah, this one's not as addictive, this one's not as bad. And Gately's going, you know, I don't know how long it's gonna take before I just can't resist anymore. Because he is an addict, you know, he does think like an addict. He is really trying, and in some ways I feel like it's a double-edged sword that he can't speak, right? Because if he could speak, he could refuse him flatly, you know, it might be more effective that way, and instead he's just writing like a skull and crossbones, and it's not really working out for him. But on the other hand, if he could speak, would he have accepted the narcotics sooner? That's the question. And he, what's interesting to me about this MD is that Gately truly hates this guy. He truly just despises him. We haven't seen that kind of malice from Gately before, and I know that it's because the MD is touching a really, really sensitive nerve for Gately. You know, he's touching this Alcoholics Anonymous kind of please do not, you know, feed me narcotics. I am a drug addict. I'm recovering. And I don't want you to contribute to my relapse. And so it seems like this MD again is just touching this nerve that Gately cannot handle to be touched at this moment, especially with all this pain that he's dealing with. And my question is for all of you out there, what is keeping Gately back? What is keeping Gately at bay from accepting the narcotics and just saying, you know what, it's fine? My guess is that it's fear, and it's sort of like there's more friction at this point that he's just really working against, more friction. And I think that friction in refusing the narcotics is created by his fear, but I want to know what you guys think. I also want to add with the MD hating thing that he's really messing up Gately's new thoughts about abiding, and this offer, this really blatant sort of pushed offer of narcotics is allowing Gately to spiral. And so Gately is in the hospital, of course he's in a lot of pain, so his mind is sort of on a single track, and he is spiraling back into this sort of shame and the sort of mindset that he was in when he was addicted. He's thinking about what it was like to have Demerol in his system. That's his drug of choice, of course. And this scene sort of ends, we continue with Gately for a long time, but sort of ends, this little mini scene ends with him grabbing the MD's balls, basically to just tell him, like, get off of my back. I cannot refuse, you know, any stronger than this. And so I think that that action effectively does end the conversation, thankfully, with that for now. Now we also, when the MD leaves, we also get this start of these memories. He's revisiting key experiences from his past that have had to do with his journey in addiction. So the first memory we get is out of sequence. This is, you know, I might add, this is how we remember things. Like, if we go on a train of memories, you know, we don't remember the first time, then the second time, then the third time. We remember, oh, maybe the color of the guy's hair, you know, 23 years after we were addicted or something. And then we go back to the beginning much later. So I really liked how in this section, it's just so realistic. It's like you're actually in the hospital with Gately, and he's walking you through all of these memories in a very realistic, non-linear way. And I've been taking a masterclass with Joyce Carol Oates to prepare for an episode, actually, so I won't say too much about it. But one thing that I really have been thinking about from her masterclass on writing is that she does talk a lot about this non-linear, non-sequential kind of writing where that's how we look at things. That's how we remember things. And we are very particular as humans about time and making sure that there's sort of a box for every hour and every day and every week and such. There's sort of subdivisions in a way that other species don't have. But at the same time, our memories are nonlinear, and beautifully so. So at the start of these memories that we get in this section, Gately is 23 years old. He's in the JFK library parking lot, and this is the start of Demerol. This is the first time he takes Demerol. What's interesting to me, I think I didn't go back and check my sources, but okay, I think that this is the same library that poor Toni Kraus later detoxes in, which I find really interesting. What is DFW saying about this poor library that all these drug addicts flock to the library? Maybe it speaks to how he knows Boston or something, or that area. If you all know more about the library than I do, please let me know in the comments. I'm very interested in this connection. And Gately's remembering his two confidants. They're sort of partners in a way, and they're called Fackelman and Kite. They're sort of his roommates. I think that's what I decided on. I was trying to figure out a word for them. They're colleagues or roommates. Both of those seem right. So Fackelman and Kite are in this luxury apartment scam business to fuel their drug and pay for their drug addiction. So what they do is they, you know, get a luxury apartment in someone else's name on credit, and then they fill it with expensive furniture, again on credit from someone else's name, and luxury appliances, then they sell everything off in the apartment, crash in the apartment for a few weeks or maybe a couple months until they get evicted, essentially. Then they do it all over again. So that's their sketchy business. There's also like an ID foraging business that Fackelman in particular is interested in, but we get more of that later. And what's interesting is we get this sort of outside perspective as Gately's remembering it, of, you know, Fackelman and Kite sort of telling him, you're totally useless when you're on narcotics. So we know Gately is this very robust person, this very, he's pretty friendly, actually. Pretty, there's a description of him later that we'll talk about, but it's like jolly a little bit. And I totally feel that from this narrative, but he's just not active. He's sort of a somnambulist in a lot of ways. He gets sort of depressive when he's on narcotics. And yet he enjoys them so much, which I found just really, really interesting. Because it seems like he's so internal when he's on narcotics that he's not realizing the effects that it's having on his personality. And yeah, it just totally alters him, which I find really interesting again. So McDade and Deal were back at the hospital. They're visiting Gately, and they say that Dune, another patient at Ennett House, is on some drug that is just too good for him. This is definitely a parallelism with Gately, right? So Dune was having some gastrointestinal stuff going on, and it's possible that he's going to have a condition that he will have for the rest of his life. And he's definitely not in a situation that was worse than Gately. Maybe he was critically ill. We did leave off with him in a pretty bad state last time, but I would say that there's sort of this parallelism where Dune doesn't refuse the drugs, and he has found his, like, miracle drug, and it's totally waking him out. It's totally, he's, like, in a lotus pose in the hospital bed and such, so there's this parallelism where Dune doesn't refuse, and he sort of is, you know, ready to get re-addicted to this drug in particular, ready to just take this drug for the rest of his life, and Gately is bearing the pain for some reason, and, you know, he keeps just saying no and refusing and abiding. McDade and Deal, by the way, August Deal, like the German actor, one of my favorite actors, he's so amazing. He was in the new Terrence Malick film that came out last fall, and just wonderful actor. Like, he's in Inglourious Basterds and a couple other films that I just adore. If you don't know about him, check him out. August Deal is his name. Okay, so Deal and McDade, they say that it's likely that Lenz got off with the 44, so it's probably possible that Lenz nicked the 44 before the finest could get at it. And then, interestingly, Ken Ardetti and Bert F. spot Lenz, and I do think that they did spot Lens. You know, this is earlier in the time frame, so this would be before, of course, Lens gets hooked on Infinite Jest and starts sawing off the other guy's fingers. But the guy that they're spotting, he's relapsed, which we know Lens has relapsed. He's wearing a sombrero. We know that Lens was wearing a sombrero. And so there's sort of a lot of clues that we get that, oh, they probably did spot Lens, probably also for the last time, unfortunately. There's news that they're moving agoraphobic, like extremely agoraphobic people into unit number 3 next to Ennett House. And the two lads want to throw a moving in party for them. And it's just funny. It's just this whole conversation is just so funny, and it's also incriminating, which I think says a lot about how people view Gately and his lucidity during his stay in the hospital. I think people sort of just think that Gately's comatose, not really there. And as I said, this is super incriminating for them because Gately's able to link them to the people who put the help wanted sign in the window of the lady that screams, "Help! Help!" like all day long, which I think is pretty funny, considering that neighborhood, considering the situation, you know, postmodernism. That's all I can say. They also give him a shoplifted get well card that's like all folded and disgusting. And Gately's going, oh my gosh, he's just going, I'm literally still a staffer. And on page 895, though, we get this sort of after the get well card appears, it's sort of a trigger for him for some reason. I think maybe because he was a burglar, and maybe he's piling up or dredging up some of those memories, not sure, but he starts feeling, quote, resentment, fear, and self-pity, unquote, over the pain that he's feeling, which is terrible. It's just a terrible headspace to be in, both as a reader and as a character. So, I sort of, when I was reading, I was like, oh, I'm rooting for Gately, and I hope that he starts healing and that his pain isn't too unbearable. I'm gonna quote from page 895 now. And this is a really key section for me. And I think this is the section for me that's enough to connect Gately to the rest of the main narrative. One, I guess, irony that we have is that Gately is really unrelated. Like, he's sort of tangentially related to himself, to Hal and this main premise of the narrative, right? Because Infinite Jest is a film that himself made for Hal to communicate with him, to entertain him. And so it's sort of about Infinite Jest to me at this point is sort of about this relationship between himself and Hal and the unfortunate things that happen in terms of this relationship never quite getting reconciled, even though there's the ultimate art involved. And so Gately, he kills Du Plessis, which perhaps Du Plessis was Avril's lover. So maybe he did something that was productive for himself, and himself might know that or not. But I think that this passage again is something that really connects Gately's thread to the original. Page 895. Because what if God is really the cruel and vengeful figurant Boston AA swears up and down he isn't, and he gets you straight just so you can feel all the more keenly every bevel and edge of the special punishments he's got lined up for you? So here it's a pretty intense climactic moment for Gately as he's sort of questioning everything. We know that he's had a lot of struggle with this notion of God, and especially AA's God. And he's trying to pray, he's trying to abide, he's trying to do things that he feels because of the system of AA will help him. And so in this ultimate round of questioning, I think that the use of the word figurant, that's something that definitely connects back to himself and Gately's conversation, himself's thoughts about Hal. And then as well, this sort of feeling of intentional punishment and intentional wickedness. And I think that sort of detachment that we see in this quote, and the sort of like detachment of Gately from himself almost, is something that we see when we're looking at the himself how narratives and trying to look at the broader perspective of this book in general. So the scene ends with this really gorgeous nurse, and she is bringing a fleet cylinder to Gately, and I'm gonna leave it there. The next scene is a Hal scene. It's in first person again. Narrator's totally disappeared at this point with the Hal scene. He comes back at the very end of this section, which we'll see with Pemulus in a minute, but Hal is having a panic attack. Page 896, the world seemed suddenly almost edible, there for the ingesting. I just like that quote. I don't know why. I think it reminds me of a Super Mario game when I was a kid, and the world was all sweets, and so you would go, and it was really difficult. I remember it just trying. It was one of those games where you have to put it away for a week and then try again and do the same thing until you complete the level, because it's just really difficult. But yeah, everything was made of sweets, and you were jumping off little mushroom, like chocolate mushroom kind of stools, and all the ground was ice cream and stuff, so yeah, it sort of reminds me of that. But Hal is super wigged out here. He is in the hallway, and he's going to check on Stice again, and then he just sort of has this existential crisis. It's, you know, it's more like a panic attack than an existential crisis, but he's sort of like, he's like calculating how many more times he's gonna have to go up this certain staircase in ETA before he transfers to college and goes up that college staircase an innumerable amount of times. Later, he starts calculating, for example, how much meat he'll eat for the rest of his life, and then how much he will defecate for the rest of his life. So he's in a really abstract state of mind right now, not the best for face-to-face interfacing, which is unfortunate. So he goes to viewing room number 5, and he just lays on the floor, and he's staring at the ceiling, and he's just wigging out, basically. My question for our audience here is, what is the significance of green in Infinite Jest? I was thinking comfort, familiarity, solitude, perhaps. I need to look at more instances of green, but this room, viewing room number 5, has muted green everywhere. The screen, the floor is this gray-green. There's a green corduroy, I think, cushions lined up on one wall. So there's all this green everywhere, and Hal takes care to notice that, and I think that we should, as readers, be critical of that and look at the significance of that color. And again, this is another place and a sort of a connection with the Gately section that we just came out of, where these wandering thoughts of Hal's are so realistic, and they're not linear, and they don't make complete sense all the time, but they are just, they're the way that we would wander and think if we were in viewing room number 5 staring at the ceiling. He's thinking about the moms and her origins, her childhood, how she didn't grow up without a middle name and has two now, how the overhead lighting systems are designed by himself, and how the moms doesn't use them because she's afraid of overhead lighting, the etymology of the word blizzard, the room itself, as I just described, all these wandering thoughts that are somehow connected in this really beautiful way on his place at ETA. And he realizes in the middle of this that it's an impossible choice between continuing weed and continuing tennis. So if he had to choose, he's not sure if he could make the choice between the two, which I find a little disturbing, I will admit, especially as someone who is trained in a similar way to Hal, you know, with music. I went to a music boarding school for a while. So it's a little disturbing, especially since I know so much, so intimately about Hal's perspective with this tennis academy thing, that he realizes, like, hey, I love getting high so much that I would give up everything for it. Or he's not sure if he would give up everything for it, I think is a better way to put that. then there's a shift in his thoughts. He's starting to think about Pemulis avoiding him all week, Hal himself used to think before he died that Hal was non-communicative, sort of figurant. He's thinking that the moms doesn't talk about himself, especially not when their communication got bad and when the week before himself died and got really bad. We also learned that Hal was at that NA meeting in, I think it's called Natick or Natick, that suburb during the Wayne episode. So unfortunately, Hal misses the Wayne episode. Wayne is doing fine, by the way. Avril was apparently with him in the hospital all night, which is, you know, questionable from what we know, and a bout of dramatic irony here. But Mario thinks it's commendable, so that's all we need. He also is thinking about how CT is probably not related to Avril, and how CT's mom was a homeodontic like Mario is. Not as severely homeodontic as Mario, I might add, but similar in terms of structure. It's a very unusual trait to have. So, you know, the fact that Mario has the same thing as CT's mom, a little questionable. The thing is about this is, you know, commenters of all sorts on the blog, on the website, on everywhere, on my email, they all are, you know, questioning, okay, who really are these boys' parents? And for me, I'm sure there's an answer for this. You know, it could be possible that CT and Avril are Mario's true parents. You know, for me, effectively, they are all brothers, and effectively, the moms and himself were their parents. You know, so for me, I'm looking at the consequences of that set of parents, the moms and himself, on these three boys, and you see it tangibly, right? You know, you might not see the physical traits of, you know, himself or the moms or whatever and all three boys, but you see the psychological effects and the behavioral effects of these two questionable parents on these three boys. And that, to me, is way more important than their actual genealogy. I might add also that Oren is the only one that has pointed this out, and he was 7 years old when Mario was born, so, and he's also a pathological liar, I might add, so, you know, if you think about it, the only real information we have about this homeodonticism comes from a child, so, you know, the child's perspective is already warped. He's a pathological liar, number two. Whether he's like that with his family all the time, not sure, but it's plausible, considering the scenes we've gotten with the dog and the phone and everything. And so, yeah, for me, I'm like, this is already just such a questionable narrative. Why go down the rabbit hole? Again, I think the behavioral and psychological traits of these boys are way more important to the narrative than their actual genealogy. Hal is then struck by the horizontality of the space. I really like this moment in the book. It's just like all the cartridges have two sides that are horizontal, and everything, you know, the tabletops are horizontal, and the ceiling and the stripes on the wall are horizontal. I find it really trippy to think about, because if you're in a room, right, and you're standing upright, you can think about all the things that are vertical along with you. Very interesting. Page 902, I find this quote really interesting and really important to Hal's perspective. Quote, "I was impossible to knock down." So he's on the floor and he's saying, "I was impossible to knock down." And he's starting to feel for tennis again. He's starting to have, you know, affected feelings about the sport, about his life, about his situation. And so for me, this quote of, you know, when he's totally immobilized, basically, he feels the strongest, that's concerning, and that's something that's really telling about his situation. All right, next thread. Gately was set, basically, since he was a child for college football and probably the show, if, you know, if we're looking that far ahead, but he dropped out of school in the 11th grade. So he goes through this thing of when he was very young to when he is up until this 23-year-old Gately that we've already seen. So he used to make bets with his big head. Like that was the party trick back in the day when Gately was drinking. Was he would put his head in the elevator. He would have people hit him in the head, and he would feel nothing. The quote that I really liked, or the description rather, was that he had a jolly ferocity. And I think that kind of jolly ferocity is still there in Gately, in a different form for sure, maybe a more mature one, more learned one. But yeah, I think that's a really fitting quote for him, really fitting description. And apparently, he started drinking and doing weed at age 9 and started doing more serious drugs at age 13. So, this experience with Demerol at age 23, we learn actually was sort of after a long time of him experimenting and doing drugs. Kite Gately knows, I think, from middle school, I think that far back, at least from high school, because Kite helps Gately out with some mathematics stuff. But he's an at-home chemist. He's sort of a nerd, sort of small, gets picked on, but he was able to form this relationship with Gately through their drug habits. And then we also learned that Kite was on the Duplessis burglary with Gately. And in footnote 363, I think this is saying in not so little words that Kite gets killed by the AFR. He certainly gets dealt with by the AFR. Between, I believe, the ages of 13 and 15, Gately experiences what he calls the attack of the killer sidewalks. He's on a certain drug and he takes that drug with alcohol, which makes him very prone to falling, and his friends experience the same thing. During this time, the MP also left his mother, and I guess him to a certain extent, for another woman who apparently had more fight than his mother. The substances eventually made him unable to pass 11th grade English, which I find to be so sad, you guys. English, when I was in high school, became my thing much later on. So, the first 2 years probably, I was not so fond of English. I was a sciences gal. And then I turned on to literature my junior year of high school. And so, you know, comparing my experience of this, like, amazing thing that I discovered and this amazing work that I discovered to Gately's total just annihilation almost by English. That's just so sad for me. And it's sad also that the substances are what made him progressively get worse and worse and just fail at this English thing. And that it was English that took him down is sort of ironic considering how notable this book is in English literature in general. And he has this devotion to football, so he would abstain from drugs for the day, and then after practice he would get high, and then he would do the same thing over and over again. So he was able to stave off the sort of the total addiction of narcotics until he took a year off from school to preserve his football stats. And during that year he had increased dependency. He was on a schedule of like every 3 hours he had to have something. He wasn't in shape as much anymore. His mom became a vegetable after an accident. And just, you know, when he returns to school and all of this starts piling onto him, there's just no chance at all of him passing high school and going, you know, to college. There's just no chance. And I think for me, when I was reading, it seems like his mother and his mother's, for lack of a better term, her death, it seems like the final nail on the coffin for Gately, the final straw for him, and he just leaves school and he just cannot do it. Next thread, Hal is still on the floor. After some time in viewing room number 5, Pemulis comes in, and Hal notes Pemulis's lack of insecurity in person, even though we know he's a mess on court, which I find really cool. And this sort of dichotomy that only Pemulis is able to embody. Pemulis needs to seriously interface with Hal, and Hal is too psyched out, too abstract to be in a position to be responsive to Pemulis at all, which is really unfortunate. I really look forward. I don't know anything about the ending of the book. Please don't spoil it for me, commenters. But I honestly don't think we're ever going to get a true interface between Hal and Pemulis after this, and I'm really sad about it. I hope that DFW proves me wrong, but who knows? We're not sure, or I'm not sure yet. And so Freer interrupts them. He comes in. He informs them that there's like half of Eustace's plastered face on the window, and so Hal goes, oh frick, you know, he goes, I was supposed to be checking on Stice, but yeah, apparently Stice is not looking too good. Apparently one of the descriptions of his face is a cheese pizza without the cheese. Then Hal starts thinking about Dr. I's funeral in Canada and about how his grave looked with that gravel. Again, these wandering, very realistic thoughts, especially in Hal's very abstract state at this point. Then he gets the Peemster to load in this viewing cartridge from himself. It's a long title, but it's called Small Clever Rooms. That's my abbreviation for it. And there's this very interesting allusion to a film called The Cage by Peterson. My question for you all is, what is this connection? I feel like I'm on the precipice of, like, getting the connection, falling off the cliff in that way. And this is really bothering me for some reason. I just want to know what the connection is with himself and The Cage. The Cage is this film about this eyeball, like, rolling around pathetically. And something I found ironic and really funny was that Hal remembers that himself was pegged as not entertaining enough by his critics because he had technical skill but no narrative skill. And of course, later he creates the ultimate entertainment, which is just so funny. Last thread, sort of. There's two threads left. One is very miniature. Last big thread for today. Gately is talking about two periods of his life before he starts recovering. So he is working for this guy named Whitey Sorkin, and I believe after that he goes to prison, etc., and then he starts reforming after that era of, like, getting out of prison, probably relapsing again, and then going to Ennett. So I think that's the last two, like, pieces that were missing from Gately. Don't quote me on it, though, that's just a guess. So Gately worked for this guy named Whitey Sorkin, and he was working with Fackelman, that's how they met, and he was doing debt collection and sort of like deal making with Sorkin's customers, and what's interesting is that he found gambling and hardcore drugs, like needle drugs addicts, he found those pitiful. And the great irony, of course, is that now he recognizes, you know, all drug addicts, including myself, are very pitiful in some ways. We also learn that Gately we go on a lot of basically misadventures with Gately and Fackelman, and we learn how they're called the Twin Towers and how they're used in different stages of cruelty when dealing with these people who won't pay their debts. We learn that Gately has killed a guy in collections, but every time he seriously messed up someone, he goes into this depression, he shoots up, like, way more than he usually does, and is just useless for a week. So this sort of guilt construct I find really interesting, really strange. And also, we sort of get, like, vestiges of this guilt with his concern and his constant concern, it seems like, about the Canadians. And I'm not sure if it's entirely selfless concern, especially since this court case thing and the Duplessis thing. So there's a lot of layers to this and his history here. There is an allusion, quickly, to how Fackelman's drug of choice makes Gately momentarily feel like an exiled toddler, and it's the same thing with the breathing ceiling, which I've been sort of questioning, was he ever on narcotics during recovery? That's my question, because it seems like, you know, this sort of different, lower grade, not sure, narcotic does make Gately feel like a big toddler. Makes him remember his childhood in some twisted sense. And we get the same things when he's like first in the hospital recovering. And you know, I don't think when he's totally lucid, it's obvious he's not on drugs because he's in so much pain. But I'm just not sure. It strikes me as very odd that there are these connections between him on drugs and having this breathing toddler sequence and then him recovering in the hospital and having the same sort of feelings and the same sort of memories and experiences. And then we end here with a scene, him, Gately, he's in an empty luxury apartment watching football, and he's ironing licenses for these rich kids in Boston. And he sees Oren in Condensa, interestingly, who I think is Oren in Condensa on TV. You know, he's just this, like, superstar, he's 2 years younger than Gately, and Gately starts crying. And then shortly after that, a couple months after, he gets arrested. All right, last scene for today on page 916 here. Pamulus is in subdorm B and he's getting out his stash. And he goes towards his stash. He has his little footstool and he realizes that the ceiling tiles all around his stash are broken. They're desiccating. And he is going, like, it's sort of like it goes in slow motion. He puts down the stool, gets on the stool, and starts reaching up into the ceiling where his stash is, and that's all we get from him. My final question to end this for you all is, what is up with all of this ceiling stuff? Like, we get Hal looking at the ceiling, Pamulus and his ceiling problems, Gately looking at the ceiling as an infant and re-envisioning that over and over. It's really interesting to me that there's all this ceiling talk. I never thought I would write the word ceiling so many times. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for your devotion to this series. It means a lot to me that you guys would stick in with me for this whole 900-something page book. Next week is our last episode on Infinite Jest. This is indeed the penultimate episode, so I hope you enjoyed this, and I immensely look forward to next week's episode, our finishing of Infinite Jest. Of course, we'll have the September after episodes, which have been leaked on Patreon. If you guys want to know them, get on Patreon. And that is all for this week. So thank you so much, and I will see you on Monday. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from us, there is a show and a series for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our website, relevanceofliterature.com, under the ongoing series tab for links to our entire back catalog of episodes. We also have a couple of open surveys that you can find through the links in the description, so if you have 3 minutes while you're waiting in line somewhere, we would very much appreciate your feedback on our show. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode, and we'll see you next time.